This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Well, the holidays have come and gone once again, but if you've forgotten to get that special someone in your life a gift, well, Mint Mobile is extending their holiday offer of half off unlimited wireless. So here's the idea. You get it now. You call it an early present for next year. What do you have to lose?
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Limited time 50% off regular price for new customers. Upfront payment required. $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds may slow after 50 gigabytes per month when network is busy. See terms.
Welcome to the Migration Podcast, your guide for waterfowl hunting tactics, gear, and conservation. And now, your host, Brian Halbly.
What is up, everyone? As Johnny M. said, I'm your host, Brian Halbly. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to tune in to the Migration Waterfowl Podcast, presented by Bluebird Waterfowl. Check out their new spinning wing decoy prototype wings. They're offering a 6-wing prototype set to anyone interested in testing them out. Check them out at bluebirdwaterfowl.com or call them at 800-564-0914 and be one of the first people to get your hands on them. This episode is also brought to you by these other fine partners, the Duck Hole and Company, Rig'em Right, Flight Day Ammunition, and CK Custom Calls. I'll tell you more about all of these partners later in the show. I just got back from our annual trout camp up in northwest Pennsylvania at my friend Jerry's camp. We've been going up there. I think we figured out we've been going up there for 18 years now, I think. 2007 was the first year we went up there. A group of friends mostly coworkers, some guys from some different law enforcement agencies from other communities, and it's just been a real blessing to get to know these gentlemen and to spend time with them over the years, especially outside of work and outside of just, you know, especially the guys from the other communities. You might only interact with them during something to do with work. So it's really nice to get out and enjoy the great outdoors and break some bread and fellowship with a bunch of other like-minded men. Occasionally we catch some trout, but we always have plenty of good food and good drink around. This was a special year. My friend and coworker Bob retired. He's been at the same place I've been working for, I want to say, close to 35 years. I came in the door about 5 or 6 years after he did. Yeah, because I'll be starting my 29th year this summer. And I'm just really happy for him. He's going to be able to enjoy retirement life and, you know, hopefully do a lot more fishing. We've been through a lot of doors together over the last 29 years. Saw a lot of stuff humans aren't supposed to see. And he's just always been a solid human being. Good man, good father, good husband. In fact, his son, Elliot, joined us at Trout Camp. He's been coming for many years as well. He lives in Virginia now, but he still makes the trip up to Pennsylvania every year for our Trout Camp. So just an all-around great weekend. Started off Saturday. We went up Friday afternoon, had dinner at camp, and just enjoyed catching up with everybody. There's quite a few of the guys, some relatives of Jerry's that have become good friends of mine that I only get to see there basically once a year. So we got to catch up Friday night. Saturday was kind of a blowout. It started raining Friday night. Got up the next day, and all the streams were pretty well blown out. We had some heavy rains Friday and into Saturday. So spent a lot of time just catching up. We had a nice tent set up outside, and when it got a little chilly, we had one of those propane heaters that we were able to put inside the canopy. Kept it comfortable, allowed us to stay outside and at least enjoy being outside instead of being stuck in the camp. But yeah, it's just real special that Bob's going to get to do a lot more of this, have more time for this. The crazy part is now I'm the most senior guy in the department, so not the oldest, thankfully, but as far as seniority goes, I've got the most time on the job there now, and that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out as I wrap up my career in the next handful of years, and just hope that we're able to keep this tradition going. Like I said, 18 years, pretty special. A lot of things. You know, it's hard to do anything for 18 years straight. And I have missed a couple over the years, unfortunately. But my wife's birthday always falls around trout season in Pennsylvania. And sometimes it gets conflicted with that. And like I've always said on the show, you know, family comes first. But it's a special group of guys at Trout Camp. And hopefully we can keep that going for at least another 18 years, if not longer. We'll see. Guys are unfortunately getting older. But, you know, it's cool to start to see guys bringing their sons as well as their sons get older. So I'll keep you posted on that. But it's something that I look forward to every year. And I'm just really in a great mood and a great place every year after being there. So kind of still flying from that, even though I had to do a bunch of yard work when I got home today, but just thankful for that opportunity. Some listeners have asked how else they can support the show besides buying another t-shirt or hat. I get it. If you've already bought a Migration Waterfowl shirt and hat and you want to support us another way, a few have also asked if we had a Patreon account. So I decided to start a Patreon account, and that will give me another outlet to provide exclusive content that doesn't make it into the podcast or on our social media. In fact, I just uploaded a bunch of photos from my trip to our annual trout camp. If you'd like to support the show over there, you can head to patreon.com/migrationwaterfowl. You can join for free or support the show by signing up for one of our three membership tiers. The friend membership will get you access to all the exclusive content and behind-the-scenes footage you won't see anywhere else. The Hunting Buddy membership will get you all the friend membership access, plus a shout out during a podcast, direct requests and suggestions for the show, and an open invitation to be a guest on the show once per year. The family membership will get you all of the Hunting Buddy membership access, plus your choice of Migration Waterfowl t-shirt or other merchandise on the Migration Waterfowl store. If you don't want a t-shirt, if you already have that, we can get you hooked up with something else over there. And a shout out on a podcast and a YouTube video. So it's kind of going to be fluid for a while. I'll be adding some more features over there. There'll be some more exclusive stuff coming up that the general public won't have access to. So hopefully I'll see you over at patreon.com/migrationwaterfowl. On this episode of the Migration Waterfowl podcast, I'll be talking with Matt Olewski and Joe Vermeulen from the Jack Miner Bird Sanctuary. We discuss the sanctuary's history, its role in waterfowl conservation, and the evolution of bird banding practices. Matt and Joe highlight the importance of community and education and conservation efforts, as well as the sanctuary's future goals and challenges. They also emphasize Jack Miner's legacy and the sanctuary's ongoing commitment to preserving migratory birds and their habitats. We talk about the multifaceted role of the Jack Miner Sanctuary in waterfowl conservation, habitat management, community engagement, and educational outreach. We discuss the sanctuary's efforts in preserving migratory habitats, managing feeding practices, and collaborating with local organizations. We also talk about challenges in obtaining funding and staffing, along with future plans to enhance visitor experiences and community involvement. Thank you to God for blessing us with another opportunity to get together for another episode. So let's get into episode number 53. Welcome back to another episode of the Migration Waterfowl podcast. I appreciate you all taking time out of your day to tune back in today. I've got my friends from the Jack Miner Bird Sanctuary here with me today. Mr. Matt and Mr. Joe, how are you doing today?
Doing great, doing just great.
Things are good, sun's shining.
That's great. Yeah, I got to meet Joe at the Toronto Sportsman Show and really had a nice talk with him and got signed up for a membership and some of those raffle tickets for the awesome prizes you guys are giving away. Why don't you run through that real quick?
Absolutely. Joe, you want to take it?
We can go ahead and start with that. So we this year, this is our second year, we are sponsored by Weatherby for the next 5 years. This is year number two. We are doing an Orion side-by-side shotgun 12-gauge. So this is our annual fundraiser. We're very proud to be working with Weatherby. It's a gorgeous gun. It's going to have Jack Miner's signature on it. Last year we did two guns. This year we're doing one. The plan is for the next 3 years, we're going to do the side-by-sides, all the Orion with the different calibers. So the tickets are $20. And like I said, this is our annual fundraiser. All the money goes back into the sanctuary, and it covers everything from the conservation lessons we teach at the sanctuary into part of our banding, as well as just our being open to the public for free. So that was one of Jack Miner's final wishes. This could be one place on Earth, regardless of your race, your religion, or your financial standing, everybody was welcome. And to this day, we do our best to maintain that. It is hard to raise money these days, so we do it through raffles. That way, the front gate is always still free.
So 7,500 stickers available, and draw date is September the 6th of this year. So we're hoping that everybody heads over to jackminer.ca, clicks on our gift shop, and heads down to the Weatherby sticker draw and makes a purchase to support waterfowl conservation.
That's awesome. Yeah, I appreciate you guys diving into that. It's really awesome to see the work that the Jack Miner Foundation's doing, and just the great people that you have involved in it all. It's just all the way around. It's a good thing for waterfowl.
It is, and this year we're really pushing the education through conservation end of it, and we're working this year with a brand new program. We started actually late last year, and that's with backpacks on ducks, digital backpacks. So we are doing that with 50ducks.com, great group of guys, and our goal this year is to try and reach 100,000 students with that digital information that's be accessible to them for free through all the schools, churches, and retirement homes also get all the information for free. So a lot of great stuff going on down here.
Outstanding. So before we get too far down the road, you guys want to take a minute and introduce yourselves and just tell our audience a little bit about who you are?
Absolutely. So my name's Matt Aliski. I'm the executive director of the Jack Miner Migratory Bird Sanctuary. And I've been here at the sanctuary for close to 3 years. I've worn many hats over those 3 years. I started off working under Joe, assisting him with the management of grounds and with our bird banding project. And I transitioned into a director of education position focused on utilizing our natural assets for curriculum-based programs, and eventually became the executive director here. And I've been that ever since June of last year. And Joe's history goes back even further.
So my name's Joe Vermeulen. I'm the director of parks here at Jack Miner Sanctuary. I started here when I was 17 under Jasper Miner, who's Jack Miner's son. Learned a lot of great life lessons as well as conservation lessons just working under him for all those years. So I've been at the sanctuary 37 years. And as long as I'm able to work, and they'll keep me working, I hope to still be here for much longer.
Excellent. So who's the history buff there? Why don't you tell us a little history about the Jack Miner Bird Sanctuary?
We can both pepper the history. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you go back to the beginning, 1865 is when John Miner, Jack Miner, is born in Dover Center, Ohio, currently known as Westlake. And Jack's born to a large family, 10 kids, and his father is a brick and tile maker. Jack's, you know, appreciation for nature was sort of, you know, thrust upon him at the age of six when he came home with a less than stellar report card. Is told by his teacher that he's unfit for the classroom. And, you know, figuratively speaking, his father took his pencil out of his hand and replaced it with a gun and said, you're not going to contribute by learning. You're going to contribute by putting food on the table. And so at the age of six, the great outdoors became Jack Miner's classroom. He learned how to track and hunt. And, by the ripe age of 13, he's shown great promise, is a market hunter, which, you know, implies his success. And him and his siblings and his mother and father immigrate to Canada. They're given a plot of land to farm. And his father, being the clay and brick maker that he was back in Dover Center, you know, once they started farming the land here and they found that there was a heavy and very shallow clay bed here in Kingsville on the plot of land they were given, restarted the minor brick and tile making factory. And, you know, all the while, Jack Minor is out there hunting, you know, Essex County. He's working with CN Rail and laying down railroad ties between Windsor and the London corridor. And, you know, when he becomes of an appropriate enough age, is employed by CN Rail to guide hunts up in Northern Ontario. While he's still, you know, working in his father's factory here, his brick and tile making factory, and farming the land. And, you know, I guess the irony, or, you know, that some people see in his story is you know, Jack Minor is the world-renowned hunter. And he's featured in sportsmen's magazines in the early 1900s, 1910s, and 1920s, before he becomes synonymous with conservation and becomes known as Wild Goose Jack, the waterfowl farmer here in Kingsville. But it's not until his 40s that he has a steady financial footing, his focus is shifting to the protection of the waterfowl that he had been hunting for so many years. And a lot of people don't realize this with the numbers of Canada geese that we see today, but they were on the verge of extinction. And Jack knew that he needed to do something about that. And Jack, being a devout Christian, first and foremost, you know, let man have dominion over God's creations. He felt compelled and he felt an obligation, a religious obligation, to protect God's creatures. And him also coming out of poverty, a species like the Canada goose, which, you know, is the food on the plate for the poor would be impacted first if they were to suddenly disappear. You know, and add in the conservation layer to things. You know, he understood the interconnectedness of living things within an ecosystem, and he understood species as being, you know, one of a stack of cards, and you pull one card from the deck and the tower falls, right? And so Jack, even though he didn't have a formal education, knew that, one, that he had the know-how to do something about it, and two, he had the will, and three, he had the resources. And though he was just one man, he took to the task. And so in 1904, he established one of North America's first waterfowl sanctuaries, you know, and he was shooting in the dark the whole time, you know, making things up as he went along, you know, trial and error all the way through, you know. And so first understands that the habitat that is his land is what is going to provide birds with what they need for survival, and works on restoration projects. His clay pits were, you know, he was accidentally creating wetland habitat here as he was just extracting clay all those years. Right. And it wasn't until about 1907, 1908 that he was finally attracting wild migratory fowl to his sanctuary. And the bird banding comes in around 1908, 1909. You want to pick up from there?
So the first band ever put on was on a black duck.
Okay.
And it was recovered in 1910. And that was the first, although other people done banding and worked on banding processes, that's the first complete one that was ever done. So Jack Minor is the pioneer of bird banding when you add full tracking from front to end. Now, up until today, our next band to go on is number 105,354.
Wow.
Understand that band is for geese, and our duck band is 114,675. Yeah. So when you put those numbers together, we're looking at, what's a quick number, over 250,000 bands have been put on. started on by one man, and realistically, Jack Miner probably put on 90,000 or so bands by himself, well, with his family. In the early bands were all hand stamped. So if it had a Bible verse or when it had a Bible verse, it would have every letter, have faith in God, the letter, the right Jack Miners, all that kind of stuff was hand stamped. So I can only pretend to imagine the numbers of hours he sat with his anvil, with his wife, choosing Bible verses in front of the fireplace in the Jack Miner homestead, stamping bands. Today we have it pretty easy. Our bands come pre-stamped with a serial number, the Bible verse on them that is chosen, and how to reach us, Jack Miner Sanctuary. We still have to handle each band 6 times before it goes on a bird. We have to stamp the year on it. We have to roll the band, and then we crimp the band, and obviously keep track of the numbers on the bands and coordinate them with the Canadian Wildlife Service band. So
sure.
It's still quite an extensive process, but it's nowhere near the process that Jack Miner
right.
went through to do it.
This episode is brought to you by Bluebird Waterfowl, creator of The Animator. The Animator is revolutionizing the waterfowl community with the world's first spinning wing decoy conversion kit. Turn your existing spinner into a water motion decoy in seconds and learn how to finish more birds with the sound of water. Guaranteed to boost your hunt or your money back. Flaring birds with your spinner is a thing of the past. Try one risk-free at bluebirdwaterfowl.com or at your favorite local outdoor supplier. So you mentioned that the first one recovered was 1910, I believe. How were they tracked back then?
How were they tracked? So that first band, just to give you a little bit more backstory, 1908, you know, the sanctuary has been established for 4 years. Jack is a bit of a local joke, to be honest with you, before he gained fame. You know, people would drive by and, you know, in horse and buggy and they'd honk at him. You know, he was known as the goose farmer around here, you know, because he had dedicated his land and his resources to waterfowl, and he wasn't making a whole lot of progress in doing so. And all the while, you know, migration wasn't fully understood. And, you know, he talked about in his autobiography how he'd be getting his hair cut and he'd talk, you know, the barber or the person next to him, their ears off about, you know, his ideas about migration. And, you know, population numbers and nesting habits and everything else. And one thing he would say often with limited evidence is that that waterfowl would return to the precise, you know, creeks and riverbed, you know, rivers and grasslands along their migration path, though he had no way of really proving it.
Sure.
And in 1908, he befriends a black duck and is able to feed buckwheat out of his hand to this duck and gets really comfortable with it. And in 1909, that same bird returns to his pond and immediately feeds from his hand. And that's Jack Miner band number one. In that moment, you know, he scooped up Katie the black mallard, ran into his kitchen, grabbed Leona, his wife's favorite set of scissors, and scratched his name into a little tiny piece of aluminum that he then crimped onto Katie. Mm. And she was harvested January 1910. In fact, if you visit the sanctuary today, you can head over to our museum and you can see that that stamp, and he hand-stamped Anderson, South Carolina, which is where it was harvested.
Wow.
And so for Jack, it was a matter of just pulling out his map and pinpointing that precise location and then getting to work, as Joe said, on hand stamping and pumping out those bands as quickly as he could. You know, it almost necessitated a second mailbox because he was just over inundated with, you know, band recoveries and letters from all over the continent. You know, he had recoveries as far north as the Baffin Islands.
Wow.
You know, he One really cool story is an Inuit man who harvested one of his Canada geese and brought it to the local priest, Catholic priest, because he couldn't read what was on the band. And that is really the initial inflection point of how that person came to find God, you know, and so Jack Miner would call it gospel by flight. You know, he would have disciples of the sky that would, work their way up and down the Atlantic flyway, sharing God's testament with everybody. And it was really just a matter of reading those letters and every single one of those letters. We've got so many of them in our archives, and they're for a lot of hunters. It is the Holy Grail even today, you know, to come across a Jack Miner band. And so you're reading, you know, some of the best moments of these hunters' lives. You know, and Jack and his maps, you know, and his data, it went on to inform public policy when it came to the protection of migratory waterfowl. And so you've got the Migratory Bird Act in 1917, which is signed by Britain and, was imposed upon the Commonwealth in the same exact year, because migratory birds don't carry passports or care about international borders. The U.S. decided that they needed to be part of the solution. Otherwise, they were going to see massive population declines or even extinctions of waterfowl. And that's really the change in the trajectory of waterfowl populations declining.
Okay. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So how has the sanctuary evolved since it was established in 1904? Kind of maybe walk us through the highlights of how it's changed so much in the last 120 years.
Well, we know what our end point is, right?
Well, goodness, how has it evolved? It has evolved tremendously, just as everything around us has evolved regarding technology, regarding ways we simply communicate. Like Matt said before, Jack Miner almost needed two mailboxes for all the letters coming in, for all the stories, for all the band recoveries. And now it's mostly done via email. It's done via just jumping on the Jack Miner webpage. But what it's brought to us at this point is we've gone from aluminum bands that we knew the beginning and the end of the flight. We really didn't know what was in the in-between, where the bird had gone, what the bird had done. So the difference is now we're doing this brand new backpack program. So we put it on the duck or the goose, and then every 15 minutes we get an update of where that bird is at, what the height is at, what the speed it's at, the weather around it. So it's absolutely amazing, and it's every 15 minutes now. So we can track that bird from the moment the band was on until it's recovered, or until the backpack retires after 5 years. So it's just amazing stuff. Whereas before there was that big gray area in the middle that there was no answer to, now we have those answers.
So banding practices have certainly evolved. And then just on this, the community engagement front of things and what the sanctuary represents to its visitors. This was a pretty wild project for Jack Miner to start. And, it didn't take long before he started to attract waterfowl in the thousands here. If you go back to contextualize, you know, anybody who was born when Jack Miner would have been born, you know, your interactions with the Canada goose would have been few and far between. By the 1930s, you could come to the sanctuary here, and during migration out in the feeding field, you could see 30,000 Canada geese.
Wow.
You know, foraging and feeding at the same time. Jack would talk about how if they ever were frightened and took flight at the same time, that the windows of his house would shake like a storm was rolling through. And that went on to, I think, put not just the sanctuary on the map, but Kingsville and this region on the map for tourism. This became the second most popular tourist destination in Canada in the late 1920s, early 30s, okay. Second only to Niagara Falls. You know, you'd see Ford Model T cars during fall migration, bumper to bumper traffic along Road 3 here in front of the sanctuary. People would spend, they'd pack up a picnic, they would get in the electric streetcar that would connect them from Detroit to Windsor down here to Kingsville. There was a stop downtown Kingsville, and they get off with their picnic baskets and they'd walk themselves up to the sanctuary and spend the entire day here, interacting not just with waterfowl, songbirds. Here at the sanctuary, we're known to feed right out of your hand or land on your hat or on your shoulder. Jack would have, you know, wild deer coming up to, you know, walking up the stairs of his front patio and eating out of people's hands. It was, he created a Garden of Eden, you know? Yeah. And so I think it evolved from tourism also to an outdoor education destination, you know? In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you get thousands of students that would visit the sanctuary on a seasonal basis and assist with and observe bird banding. And it was Jasper Minor who used to do that in front of hundreds of kids every single day during migration. So
okay. This episode is also brought to you by The Duck Hole & Company, Attracting Feathers Together. They are a full-service habitat company located in North Carolina. If you have questions about waterfowl habitat or need some work done on your property, contact them through any of their social media platforms at The Duck Hole & Company. They can also fix you up with golden millet, also known as the duck buffet, and the best bang for your duck.
Yeah, I think our whole world has evolved in the fact that it's too easy now, in my opinion, for kids to just sit and play video games or watch TV or play on social media. Whereas at the sanctuary, we are doing our best to, I'm going to say, reintroduce conservation, working outside, being outside, working with the ducks, the geese. We just created a brand new 14-acre wetland area with help from Ducks Unlimited and
Trails,
Urca, new trail system, all kinds of great stuff that's all outdoors. We're still very family-orientated here. We encourage families to go out and spend as much time here as they can, and we do that by putting on different events throughout the year. We have a movie night. We have wild game dinners. We have... National Migration
Wildlife
Week.
Yeah, National Wildlife Week, which is a national celebration of Jack Miner's legacy.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people don't know that, but that lands on the week of his birth date, April the 10th, every single year. Hmm. Migration Fest.
We just had a big sportsman show here in regards to hunting and fishing. It was a great sportsman show. We had a chili fest last weekend. So we're doing everything we can to get people outdoors again, enjoying the sanctuary. One of the biggest things that happened in the sanctuary recently that helped us was COVID. COVID had locked everybody inside and made everybody stir crazy. At the sanctuary, we have some beautiful trails, over 6 kilometers long, and it pushed people outside, but where they had no place to go. We've been here for over 100 years, and it pushed people our direction. So financially, it didn't do anything for us, but as far as awareness, it was just a huge blessing for us and it helped bring people back to the sanctuary.
Absolutely. And then to tie it back to banding, we're hoping to, by spring of 2026, to offer banding experiences here at the sanctuary. So we want to get everybody who can't get enough of the history to immerse themselves in the history and to come here, stay in a historic building for a couple of days, wake up at the crack of dawn after doing a little bit of workshopping and assist Joe here in our 1912 swim in Jack Miner capture net and band waterfowl for a few hours here, there, and everywhere. Assist with different banding practices that we do here, different wildlife and habitat restoration projects while they're here. We want to create an immersive, historical, experiential experience for people so that they get to, you know, experience the magic that we get to experience every single day.
Very nice. So you mentioned capturing birds Walk us through that process for people that may not be familiar, how you catch them and how you band them.
Well, it's the same process that Jack Miner used. We have a flooded oak clay pit that he had set up. It has a big steel structure over it. So if you picture the old squirrel box with a cardboard box, a stick and a piece of corn and a string, similar idea. The center of the net stays up. We keep it flooded underneath the net for certain times of the year, approximately 8 to 10 inches deep. And we feed heavily in that water. We do have a hide up in the trees on the east end of the net. Now, to give you a size of the net, it's about 50 feet across and approximately 80 feet long. And the center is about 10 feet off the ground, minus that 8 or 10 inches of water. And the outsides are up on little trip poles. They run the full length of the net. And then a cable goes underground up to our little hide. So every day we go back there and we bait it. And then we go sit in the hide, or we'll bait it and go sit in the hide at the end of the day. So there's been many, many days you sit in the hide and you don't see a gosh darn thing. But you know what? It was still a beautiful place to sit and watch the sun go down or the sun come up. But when we do get the opportunity for a catch, then the work begins. Then the bands get started to be made. The phone calls start going out to all of our volunteers. We prep our staff of three of what our plans are for the day and how things may have changed for our day's planning, and we get set up for it. And it usually takes us, I'm going to say 3 hours to half a day to get our banding done, depending on the size of the catch. And then there's all the backup work, the putting everything on the computer, logging all the information, and all that other kind of great stuff. So it's not every day we get a catch. It's a Mother Nature-based process. It is a very rewarding when you get a catch, because there's so many days you don't get a catch. But like I said, it's still great to watch that sun come up and go down sitting in that hide.
Sure. A lot like taking a gun with you, but still don't get to enjoy it.
Don't tell anybody.
So has the primary mission changed at all over the years? And what is the primary mission today compared to when it was started?
Well, the mandate is to offer a natural, historical, and educational setting here with the, you know, the preservation, the conservation of waterfowl at the forefront. And, as we talk about how things have evolved, it's really funny because though the delivery of the historical part and field trips has evolved, really the roots haven't changed at all. Jack Miner was he would spend months and months at a time on the road engaging with the public and informing the public of what he was trying to do, and sharing his conservation efforts with everybody clear across the continent and in Europe. We do that through our engines of social media, and we prioritize that community engagement component on a daily basis. When I started here working under Joe, one thing, he set me straight on is it didn't matter what you were doing, what you thought you were in the middle of. You put your paintbrush down and you put your tools down. And if somebody walks onto the sanctuary grounds, you engage with them.
Okay.
Nothing was more important to Jack. He passed that down to his kids, to Jasper, who passed it down to Joe, and Joe's passing it down to younger generations of folks to stop what they're doing and do what is most important, or what was most important to Jack, and that is engage with your visitors. You know, people at the end of the day will not care to invest in or protect what they do not understand.
Sure.
And understanding only happens when you do the educational component of what we do. So going back to banding practices, some of the tools that we use are the exact same tools that Jack handled back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Our crimper.
So we had a school group here today, and the three teachers made a commemorative band for themselves to take back to school. And they literally used the same crimper that Jack Miner used to put all those bands on that many years ago. Up until recently, we had a very gifted machinist build us a copy of it in case anything ever happens to this one, because if something happened to it, we'd kind of be poop out of luck. But so we now have a duplicate to it. We haven't used it yet. We got it sitting in a safe place. And if we need it, we have it. So it's pretty exciting. Even the anvil that some of the bands are stamped on to this day is still the anvil that Jack Miner used.
That's really cool.
So, I mean, yeah, the aluminum bands, they're still the most economical. They're the easiest to put on, the easiest to access. You know, it's still the most effective way. And it's funny how some things never change after 100 years. Yeah.
That's great. This episode is also brought to you by Rigam Wright Waterfowl, producers of the most well-designed and well-built products, tried and tested by the most heavily seasoned hunters on the planet. Their mission has always been and will always be to design, build, and supply the most innovative and high-performance hunting products available at a reasonable price. They will not succumb to outside pressure to cheapen their products, and will continue to take bold steps and huge risks to separate themselves from their competition. They dominate in customer service, knowing that their end-use customers are the very backbone of their existence. Above all else, they operate with honesty and integrity and treat people fairly, never compromising these principles in pursuit of profit. Check them out at rigamright.com or your favorite local outdoor retailer. So if somebody was to ask, you know, they want to support you, but they want to know maybe what can the sanctuary hang its hat on for what they've contributed to wildlife conservation, particularly regarding migratory birds?
Well, the first thing I would say is I think you see and you engage with the Canada Goose because of Jack Miner. You know, if there's one person who single-handedly saved a species from extinction, it's probably him. You know, and there were a lot of other waterfowl species at that time that were, you know, the trajectory of those populations was heading the same way. And the work that has been done by this sanctuary informed scientists and public policy to make common sense changes. And we continue to do that work today, which informs public policy and scientific reporting of waterfowl today. In addition, the sanctuary is close to 450 acres of a variety of habitats. It is mandated, it is government law, that nobody can hunt within a 5-kilometer radius of the sanctuary.
Okay.
When you're supporting the sanctuary, you are supporting a protected migratory stop for waterfowl to rest, to nest, to forage, to do what they need to do to survive migration, and to keep those population numbers stable. So you're supporting preservation and conservation of significant habitats for waterfowl.
And I would say the second part of that, but well intertwined, is the educational end of it. So if you look back in lots of Jack Miner's early stuff, it was education with students and young kids, even education that he taught at his local churches. And to this day, we still do our best to promote Jack Miner Sanctuary, but promote the conservation end of it. And it's been a really booming project that Matt has taken over in the last year and a half. And we can proudly say that in the month of May, we have no days that have no...
There's no availability.
That's right.
We are fully booked for school programs these days.
That's great. So,
you know, what we pride ourselves in that, in updating our programs, ensuring that, you know, teachers are buying into an offsite program that is valuable and worthy and curriculum aligned. So our programs have evolved with, you know, education programs, and dovetail really nicely with the programs that are being delivered in the classroom. And you know, a support of the Jack Minor Sanctuary is a support of our drive to evolve and to remain scientifically significant. You know, sure. Joe pointed out the GPS transmitter project, you know, and the partnership with 50 Ducks. Those transmitters aren't cheap.
No.
You know, you're talking about close to a $2,000 commitment for a single transmitter to learn more about waterfowl. But that is the data points that you're going to get and what you're going to learn. You know, our traditional band, you know, has a giant gap in the story of waterfowl. We capture the bird, and there's a lot that we learn in the moment during the initial banding, and there's a bit more that we learn when it's recovered. But what happens in between, that, you know, we need to do a lot more data collection to fill in the rest of the story. And so, right. Support of the sanctuary is a support of having a better understanding of waterfowl and how we as human beings can coexist with them.
Outstanding. So we all know that you're pretty focused on duck and goose species. Are there any other bird species that you do any work for or with in the sanctuary?
Well, we have partnerships with a number of local bird organizations. You know, for example, the Purple Martin Association was just here for Wildlife Week doing their work and engaging with the community. The Pelee Island Bird Observatory has been here too, representing what they do for migratory songbirds. So we have very healthy relationships with our community partners in the bird wing of things. But I think we like to stay in our lane when it comes to migratory waterfowl. Gotcha. You know, we know what we're good at, and like I said, we stick to what we are good at.
Okay. You talked a little bit about the habitat. Kind of walk us through, you know, how you manage that habitat to support the ducks and the geese there.
So we have approximately 125 acres that's in farm ground here. Of that 125 acres, approximately 30 acres every year gets put into corn, which we keep in our crib. So we serve the geese corn on the cob. For the simple reason that it was tried being shelled corn and too much got wasted. So by being on the cob, it was just easier for them to get it, and it doesn't get packed in the mud. So we feed approximately 3,000 bushels of corn a year. And through that process, it's grown jointly with a neighboring farmer that assists us with that project. We have about 11 acres that we personally manage right up front to keep our geese for their daily feeding. So we'll go in there and harvest a few rows at a time. And then when the snow and the ice hits, that's when we really try to dig into our corn crib, or if our front fields aren't to that maturity level yet. We also feed in our front pond lots of buckwheat that school kids feed, as well as we use for our own feed throughout the year. And we even often, not so much that we push the sunflowers, but we do encourage some sunflowers to be planted around here because the geese like to forage on the little plants when they're small. So that's the main ones we use for feeding. But as far as the management of the property, it's a very time-consuming job. It takes a lot of manpower, and we're blessed with some great volunteers. I can say we have some amazing volunteers just to come in and help us cut grass. We cut over 14 acres of grass every week. We have the 6 kilometers of trails that we have. Two wonderful retired gentlemen that literally spend every day out there fixing, or one way or another, moving a branch, putting down wood chips. And then there's the regular ground maintenance. There's the bathrooms to upkeep, our stadiums, our ponds, our nets, our fences. So it's a huge job, but we're best blessed with many volunteers that can help us in many different ways with their own personal talents. And so if you think of a farm, a regular farm, mix that up with some waterfowl, add a little touch of tourism there, a great big block of education, and a few trails to take care of, and that's what we take care of.
Okay. So one of the controversial issues today, a lot of southern hunters want to blame like the corn fields that are left standing and things like that for kind of slowing the migration or even stopping it in some arguments. What are you seeing at the sanctuary? You're feeding corn. Are you seeing birds still coming and going normally, or are you seeing them hanging around more?
It's a great question, because of the population of non-migratory birds that's around seems to always get tied into that same conversation you're having in regards to where the migration's going, where it's starting, where it's stopping. My own personal opinion, I think no-till farming has had a huge impact on the migration of ducks and geese, in the fact that they're no longer forced to go as far as they used to, because with no-till farming, they're not plowed every year. The fields aren't plowed, so it leaves lots of grain sitting on top of the fields. So that's one. I think the other thing that hunters often miss is one of the reasons the birds aren't migrating as far anymore. Well, there might be a little bit of climate change in there too, is that there's not the hunting pressure there used to be. Because with no hunting pressure, the geese and ducks can literally stop wherever they want to stop, as opposed to back in the original days, Jack Miner had the sanctuary, the ducks and geese had to come here to be out of hunting range. Without the hunting pressure and with the no-till farming, I think that has affected it. Do we still believe birds travel just as far? Yes, we do. But I think, like I already said, with the mix of non-migratory birds that get swung into those flocks, it makes it really a gray area of how many birds are migratory and how many really weren't migratory birds.
And before no-till, I mean, this sanctuary was that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Yeah, they would fly over barren farmlands that were plowed over for the winter time and find nothing to forage on along the way as they migrated, and they would come here and we'd be spreading out corn for them. And really a change in farm practices resulted in a change in the number of migratory waterfowl that we were able to attract here. So it ties back to that farming component.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I appreciate you going into that. I get asked that a lot, and it's nice to get different opinions from different parts of the country and North America for sure. This episode is also brought to you by Flight Day Ammunition. Flight Day Ammo was born in the heart of the Mississippi Flyway in West Central Missouri. Founder Ben Myers and his family have duck hunted this region of the country for over 50 years. Ben's passion for quality ammunition led to the development of his own brand. Flight Day utilizes the best components in the ammo industry, which provides unmatched quality, patterns, and lethality. Check them out at flightdayammo.com and be sure to use discount code MW10 at checkout to save 10%. So you mentioned working with 50 ducks. I had Greer on the show quite a while back. Super interesting organization. Love what they're doing. What other organizations are you guys working with, and what kind of projects are you doing with them?
So our local conservation authority, IRCA, the Essex Regional Conservation Authority, and Ducks Unlimited Canada recently funded a 14-acre wetland restoration project. So if you can imagine a back corner of a field that was prone to flooding all the time, really wasn't yielding that much in terms of a harvest. We decided to take it out of production completely. They came in, engineered the soil, and essentially built a pond where it wanted to be anyways. We've got this creek system that runs through our Kennedy Woods forest, and it is fed by this flooded out corner of a field, and it feeds what we call Mud Creek here. That was a huge project, 8,800 trees planted in that plot, and in a brand new wetland, which is doing its job to attract migratory waterfowl. We've got our 4-H groups So our animal husbandry groups and farming groups and outdoor farming groups that meet here on a regular basis. We've got scouting groups that utilize the grounds and our building assets. We support homeschools that need an outdoor education space. Canada Southland Trust, which focuses on forest restoration and protection. Their board's been reestablished in the region, and they utilize our buildings for their board meetings. And so we have lots of partners. Our partners are just endless. Weatherby, of course.
Weatherby, Essex County Retrievers Club.
Essex County.
Train here, do the dog trials here. We've also do our best to make sure we belong and interact with all of our local hunting and conservation clubs, whether it be Delta Waterfowl, Turkey Federation, Gosfield North Sportsmen. We attend their banquets. We do our best to support them any way we can with use of our grounds, helping them with educational materials, to try and keep it a nice, tight community, and to understand what their projects are so they can help understand what our projects are. And I think we've done a good job of that. Not to saying we can't always do more, but you can always do more. So that's something we're really proud of too, is that we've created that network of
collaboration.
Collaborations is the right word, yes. So that's something we're definitely working hard on.
Very nice. So somebody like me that's never been there in person, what could I expect when I visit the sanctuary there?
Well, Matt's going to put down his paintbrush when you walk up the front walkway. And if you ever get a chance to come, please do. So you're going to pull up out in front of the sanctuary overlooking a field with a nice gazebo and a pond. I'm looking at it right now, and I probably have 50 geese out there and a couple of ducks swimming around just enjoying themselves. If you came today, you're going to see ducks and geese in the front pond where the kids feed. Our museum is open. The house is open. We have a nice big parking lot. It is kind of a quiet country road, Ron, although it is paved. And then the first thing you walk into, hopefully you'll be greeted by staff that's working in the area, right into the Jack Miner Homestead. And we've done our best over the last numerous years to recreate it the way it was. We have some lovely ladies that come in. And we even have the original Jack Miner china and his wife's china that we changed throughout the years. So it's always decorated to be festive for the time of year that it is. Following that, you can go back to the Jack Miner grave site. We have the Flight 120 memorial cabin back there by the grave site. That's a great honor to the people who passed away in that flight.
There's the Jack Miner Learning Center. So that was opened 2.5 years ago as a little engagement hub for younger kids and kids of an older stature to learn through play and play-based activities. There's the Jack Miner Museum, which houses all of our, pioneer conservation history. You can look at old banding records, old bands, Jack Miner's tools, get a better understanding of all of his famous connections. He was good friends with Henry Ford, Ty Cobb, Thomas Edison. We've had U.S. presidents, prime ministers visit the sanctuary, and there's all of that really rich history to take in there. If you come during migration and we happen to be banding, then that changes the course of things because we still utilize that 1912 swim and capture net, and you might see Joe in his hide falling asleep and waking himself up before he makes a capture. And the experience continues from there. We've got, like Joe mentioned, the 5.5 kilometers of trails. We've done our very best to chisel out public spaces that don't interrupt migratory waterfowl, so we can all kind of coexist here at the sanctuary. And if you're lucky enough to show up during one of our events, there's even more to do.
And the other great thing is, even to promote, Kingsville is a wonderful little town to come, friendly town to come and visit while you're here at Jack Miner's. We have some great tour stops at both ends of the road. So a lot of great stuff going on here. And we're open 7 days a week. It's a great place to stop and visit.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier all the programs you have going on year round. Is there like a couple of maybe highlights if somebody just had one or two opportunities to come by that you'd recommend over anything else?
I would say Migration Festival.
Absolutely. Every year, the third weekend of October is Migration Festival. You'll you will stumble on, well, that's the sort of the beginning of migratory season.
Yep.
But there is no end to the activities that are happening here during that 2-day festival that happens every year, Saturday and Sunday. And we collaborate with the town of Kingsville on that. You know, it is Migration Festival is an event that the special focus of it is the legacy of Jack Miner. And so okay. A lot of what you will experience and see, you know, is tied to the sanctuary or is tied to enjoying nature. Because at the end of the day, Jack, you know, he would say if you can get somebody out there, out in immersed in nature, that is the first step to making somebody who has no understanding of nature a young naturalist. And so, it's a festival that encourages people to get out and to have fun outdoors. And then National Wildlife Week, I would say, is probably the second one. So, okay. Like I said, it is timed with Jack Miner's birthday, April the 10th, every single year. So wherever in the calendar his birthday falls, it is that entire week of activities. And our activities range from, we've got birds of prey shows. We've got arts vendors with focuses on, nature. We have trolley rides. We've had archery here. Last year was amazing. It was timed with our solar eclipse. We had thousands of people visit the sanctuary during that time. It was impressive. So we encourage people to come out anytime. Anytime you can book a private tour with us through our website. Teachers can book field trips if you're local. If you're not local, stay tuned because our plan is to pivot virtually and to offer virtual experiences, virtual tours and field trips of the sanctuary in the future. We kind of just plugged into fiber optic and we're really excited to sort of enter the 21st century in terms of how we engage with our visitors. And we hope to bring the sanctuary to people all over the world through our devices. So
let me quickly jump on back to 50 Ducks. You were talking about teachers, so I'm sure there's some teachers out there that listen to your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
If they can get in touch with us, we can put them in contact with Greer, or get in touch with 50 Ducks directly, all teachers get the free passcode to watch 50 Ducks. So go online, see what the ducks are doing. It's all paid for. So if they can get in touch with us, that only helps us get that 100,000 students touched with the story of conservation. Through the 50 Ducks platform, mm-hmm. and I just think that's a great thing that we should be promoting also as well as we make this turn in education.
Absolutely, that's great. This episode is also brought to you by CK Custom Calls, custom built in the USA from the great state of Texas. Handmade in a world of mass-produced. Check out their calls on their Instagram and Facebook pages at CK Custom Calls. They showcase calls for sale there, and you can also contact them for a custom order. What do you think the biggest challenges that you're facing at the sanctuary today?
Funding. It is difficult. You know, this is a huge project. And if you can imagine what it takes to manage 450 acres of land, we do it with so few staff. It would boggle some people's minds. We have only three part-time staff. There's three full-time staff here, two part-time. So we rely heavily on our volunteers and partners for help just to manage the land. But in terms of, the cost associated with our banding projects, maintaining our historical assets, it is enormous. And so our fundraising efforts are our focus. And I would say that if anybody has the means or feels compelled by the story or the narrative of Jack Miner, and the impact of the work that we do today. There is more than one way to help, and we're not always asking people to open up their pocketbooks, but if they have the means to do it, we appreciate that support, and we couldn't exist without it. We do not receive regular government grants or funding that offsets our operational costs.
Okay.
So I would say that is the greatest challenge, and that is our greatest focus.
Sure. So you've got the raffle tickets, you've got memberships, you have people that can come and volunteer. Anything else that any other avenues people can chip in on?
I think it's an endless way that people can help us out. It could be as simple as somebody might have contacts that they could help us get aluminum for cheaper, that we could get bands made. It could be anything at all. Maybe somebody has a contact to make hats like the one you're wearing.
Okay.
That could have jack miners on it, that could help us in the long run. So I think the opportunities are endless the way they can help the sanctuary.
And it could be something as simple as just following us, liking our posts, sharing our posts. Because at the end of the day, you know, a lot of these fundraising drives are driven through social media, and just clicking share
can
be enough, because it spreads the word.
Yeah, it's almost like sometimes people's fingers are so tired from scrolling, they don't have the energy to hit that little heart and that little triangle. I always give my friends a hard time about my stuff that I post too, so I feel your pain.
Yeah. Well, opportunities like this are great, because, you know, I think that's sort of been the name of the game for us for the last year and a half. Joe and I have been on a number of podcasts, and we've seen how it's translated into, you know, further discussions about what we do here, phone calls of support, donations, people visiting our gift shop online, people liking our posts and sharing our posts. There's a limitless way that people can support us, but these podcasts have been great, because, you know, who's coming to you? You know, it's people with that nuanced interest in what in waterfowl, and that's what we do. And so we're certainly more than just waterfowl, but those are our roots, and these podcasts have really helped out. So thank you so much for the invite onto yours.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a great conversation. So looking to the future, what goals does the sanctuary have for expanding its impact or even its facilities?
Well, I was just going to say, before we jump into the future, let's just take a step back. So we've mentioned numerous times on this podcast the word family. And so I'm going to let Matt just quickly tell you a story about 2 days ago. Matt had a gentleman stop in. He was 92 years old.
93.
And he was a masonry man, correct?
Yep, he was a mason. Yeah, so we had a really interesting moment of engagement about a year ago. A man who was born and raised here in the Kingsville area, his father was a mason who built our original Jack Miner obligatory. It was where he would park his horse and his buggy back in the 1910s and 20s. But when his sanctuary was established, he converted it into an observation tower. He called it his obligatory, and it had the 360 blind up at the top there. And when Jack Miner passed away in 1944, his crypt was built by this man's father. And, you know, I was pulled out of my office and told by one of our staff members that you have to come down and you have to be an ear for this guy, because the stories he has are absolutely incredible.
I bet.
You know, he was telling us stuff about Jasper Miner that we didn't know about, you know, hidden, you know, histories of people just, you know, just waiting for the right ears to listen. But just so happens that man just passed away in February of this year. And the granddaughter that carted him here and by demand to speak with me or members of the sanctuary, she said just how special this sanctuary was to her family. You know, it meant so much. You know, all of her fondest memories with her grandfather were of them in the public viewing pond feeding buckwheat to ducks and geese. And she said, you know, my grandfather didn't leave me with much, but he left me with a nominal amount of money that I can't think of a better organization to support. And I would like to redirect it to you folks. You know, going back to that story of just the importance of engaging with people, because you never know what a conversation is going to lead to. But where were you going to take that, Joe?
Well, where I was taking it was, you know, we have the grandfather, granddaughter. It's the family. It's the years, the generations of people that came here. So we want to encourage that to keep going. So we feel by doing our outreach programs, by doing our Chili Fest, by doing all these great things, we can keep getting families to come here and come here. So what are we trying to do in the future? We definitely want to promote conservation. We definitely want to keep the sanctuary up and running. But we want to keep it going at the same base level of family function that that we can.
Yeah. And you know, informing the younger generations of the importance of this history. History can so easily be lost.
For sure.
You know, and we've learned that here because for a while, you know, our the way that we were engaging with teachers and students was not evolving. And there was a period of time where students' field trips were not happening here. And it resulted in two or three generations of kids who lived right here in Kingsville, Ontario, who lived here in Windsor, Essex County, and did not know the significance of Jack Miner's name.
Right.
You know, and so it is on us. We take onus to ensure that we remain laser focused for generations to come of transferring that important knowledge to younger folk and keeping this history alive. And moving forward, you know, we have to evolve the way that we generate revenue, you know, the way that people want to engage through tourism or through visits of historical landmarks is changing. People want to experience what a tourism destination offers, not just be an earpiece for a story. And so that's what that banding experience component will be for us. It'll be a way to, like I said, give somebody an immersive historical experience of this sanctuary and what it has been doing for well over a century and doing quite well.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate the time, gentlemen. I've taken up an hour of your day. I want to give you an opportunity to cover anything we might have missed, and you can plug how people can find you and where they can get those raffle tickets.
Yeah. So firstly, if you're lucky enough to recover one of these Jack Miner bands, the Holy Grail, head over to jackminer.ca and don't be afraid to share with us your data. We will, as a little token of gratitude, we'll make sure we get out a recovery certificate of appreciation to you, and we'll send you out a commemorative band as a little thank you. While you're at the website, there's lots that you can do. You can learn the history of Jack Miner. You can support us. You can volunteer as a bird banding assistant. You can learn about our events. You can head to our gift shop and support us through our fundraising efforts. Again, thanks to Weatherby for the donation of the Orion side-by-side. That's running until September the 6th of this year. Purchase your sticker. You'll automatically be entered into a draw. Your odds are great. And your money is an investment in conservation and what we do here to keep that history alive. What else, Joe? That's
my
pitch.
I think it's funny because you were just talking about people coming into town on the electric car, walking out here to have a picnic. And there's a couple right there walking out to the gazebo carrying a picnic basket. So I don't know of a better way to wrap that up than just saying,
Visit us.
Come on out and enjoy the place. We're free. Even if you can't stay for the day, stay for an hour. So come on out, visit us, and enjoy everything we have to offer.
And if somebody wants to volunteer, is there contact information on there for getting a hold of somebody if they want to spend some time helping?
So our volunteer registration is all done through our website.
Okay.
You can tick off all of the boxes of interest. We'll take what we can get, anything from mowing lawns to maintaining trails to assisting with habitat restoration projects and bird banding. We will take you when you have time, and we will take whatever skills and experiences that our volunteers are willing to offer.
Excellent. Well, Matt and Joe, I appreciate your time. Thanks for spending a little bit of a... Yes, sir. And good luck in the future. And if there's anything else we can ever do to help you guys out here, just let me know.
Thank you so much.
Sounds good. Well, thank you.
Huge thank you to Matt and Joe for taking time out of their day to join me on the show. And thank you all for tuning in to this episode. I really appreciate it. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at Migration Waterfowl. We also have a Facebook group for the podcast. Please join us there as well. And if you could, please check out our YouTube channel and subscribe while you are there. Lots of great content coming that way throughout the rest of the year. You can find the link to our merchandise store in the show notes below or on our Facebook and Instagram pages. Check out our shirts, hoodies, thermoses, coffee, and more over there. And now through the end of May, 10% of everything we sell will go to Ducks Unlimited. Thank you to everyone who has been purchasing merchandise and supporting the show. If you like what you've heard here, please take a moment and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Send me a message or email after you leave the review, and I will mail you a podcast decal. And get out there and enjoy the outdoors, but make sure you seek out a relationship with the one who created everything. Psalm chapter 85, verses 6 through 9 says, "Will you not revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your unfailing love, Lord, and grant us your salvation. I will listen to what God the Lord says. He promises peace to his people, his faithful servants, but let them not turn to folly. Surely his salvation is near those who fear him, that his glory may dwell in our land." And remember, the migration is coming. Be ready when it arrives. Tune in next week to hear another great guest on the Migration Waterfowl Podcast.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
Your little one grew 3 inches overnight. Adorable. Also, expensive. Sell their pint-sized pieces on Depop and list them in minutes with no selling fees. Because somewhere, a dad refuses to pay full price for the clothes his kids will outgrow tomorrow. And he's ready to buy your son's entire wardrobe right now. Consider your future growth spurt budget secured. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.